You're tuned in to Rosie on the House today, and we are sharing our favorite memories of 2015. We do have interest outside of home improvement, and the 7 a.m. hour is ours to share them with you. Dr. Dean, professor at Grand Canyon University, revealed interesting facts about the Constitution and Labor Day. And our friends the Posterinas of Posterina Pools shared their love of adventure and what it takes to hike the Grand Canyon rim to rim to rim.
And this hour, we've got one of our most popular guests ever in studio, Dr. David Dean, earned his PhD in history from Arizona State University, currently an assistant professor at our own little Grand Canyon University here in Phoenix, Arizona, joins us and talks history, history, history. He's absolutely unstumpable on the topic of history. We've got Constitution Day just coming up around the corner.
Yeah, September 17th. That celebrates the day that the signers of the Constitution gathered and signed that important document before they sent it out to the states for ratification.
Okay, so this Labor Day weekend, as you're barbecuing your brats and your burgers and drinking your cold drinks and eating your chips, let's have a Constitution Day trivia class.
Which is good because the Iowa Public Schools started recognizing Constitution Day as early as 1911 and holding contests. A lot of colleges and universities hold events on Constitution Day to remind people of its information and its facts and those kind of things.
Certainly doesn't bring the attention that 4th of July does.
No, but 4th of July was that really declaration. We're declaring our independence. But this was more like, okay, now we got to govern ourselves and this is our document. Maybe we should figure what that has out.
Maybe less drama, just no less result, right?
Right.
We declared our independence on July 4th. Then we threw together like some Articles of Confederation that kind of morphed into the Constitution that had to go through like a complicated ratification process. Am I close?
You're close. The Articles of Confederation were designed, now that we've declared our independence and we have to govern ourselves, okay, how are we going to do that? And so the Articles of Confederation were created by the delegates from each of the 13 states who came together to say, okay, now this is how we're going to fight this war, because we're now at war, and how are we going to take care of each other? Unfortunately, there was a lot of weaknesses in the Articles of Confederation. There's no judicial branch. There was no Supreme Court or anything. There was no power to tax. So if the federal group needed money, they had to ask each of the individual states for a check. That was always kind of complicated. And it took 9 of the 13 states to approve any measure, but it also took all 13 if they wanted to change this document.
It's kind of a miracle that all really worked.
Right. The Articles of Confederation got us through the war and actually gave us kind of the pattern for how we were going to add states with the Northwest Ordinance. But it really didn't set up for how to govern the people. So they realized that they needed a new document, and they collected together some writers. And they're using those principles of the social contract that the people should choose who govern them, that those who govern them should have some checks and balances on that. That's all from our Enlightenment writings. And so they created a document that had three branches of government. And even in creating that, there were some debates. Representation, the little states with small populations, should they have an equal vote as the bigger states like Virginia and New York? And so a compromise was made. Let's create two houses of Congress, one that's based on equal representation, and let's have one that's based on popular representation. And that's how we get our Senate and our House. And all of those things were part of the debate forming it. But now we've got to sell this thing to the people. And there was a series of laws, what we know as the Bill of Rights, that were included, but some people didn't like those because there was too much federal power. Mm-hmm. Some people loved them. They thought this helped protect the little guy. And so that was they took them out, and then they sent the Constitution around, and part of the sell job was, if this passes, now we have a way to amend this, and we could send these amendments around and put them back in state by state on that ratification process. They needed 9 of the 13 states to actually ratify the Constitution.
So we've got the birth of this country, and we've got the Federalist Party,
mm-hmm.
and they're really about consolidating power into a federal central bureau.
Right. The Federalists were centralizers. They believed that the federal government's purpose was to make sure that the country ran smoothly, and that when people gave them those authorities to do so, they would do a good job.
And the primary forefathers' names, everyone would know, that fell into the Federalist political party?
Most likely Alexander Hamilton was their biggest champion.
Okay.
And then Washington was the Federalist. And they're looking to protect businesses, people who are manufacturing. They were wanting things like a strong bank. They think that tariffs should be high so that American goods are supported and foreign goods are taxed so they don't come in. And they wanted, wanted to make sure that Americans were good, upstanding citizens and were educated and those kind of things.
And those that weren't Federalists were?
Well, and fortunately, they got a really good publicist along the way and changed their name from the Anti-Federalists to the Republicans.
Okay.
And that would have been Thomas Jefferson's party. Again, these more representing the farmer, the planter, the individual.
The individual, states' rights.
Kind of thing. And it's a decentralized kind of thing. Their thing was let's let our local, our state populations, let our state governments handle things. And we'll only give power to the federal government if we really think that we alone can't take care of something. Then we'll pass that power to the federal government. Otherwise, let's not give that federal government too much power.
I know which party I'd have been a part of. That's a pretty easy decision, right? As much as I revere George Washington, I would not have been a member of the Federalist Party. Dr. Dean, Labor Day kind of honors labor. It kind of started in the late 1800s after the Civil War, Industrial Revolution's building up. People are beginning to think maybe the capitalists, industrialists aren't treating the labor quite as well and respected as they should be. And the start of Labor Day is kind of a progression of events.
You hit it right on the head that Industrial Revolution really changed the American worker. And, they're feeling like these long hours, the safety conditions. And so there was a lot of agitation. But there also the machine was really replacing the humanity aspect of work. And so the call for a Labor Day celebration was started kind of in New York in 1882 about just celebrating workers and what they do, what they contribute, and that celebration. They were actually going to have a Monster Labor Festival is what they were billing it as. And it ended up being a parade through the town. They sold 20,000 tickets, 10,000 people in this parade.
And this is New York City proper.
In New York City.
Okay.
Uh-huh. And that was it was declared kind of a day of the people. And then that kind of got the ball rolling in terms of Labor Day or celebrating. We should have a day sometime to celebrate that.
Okay. All right. So we get it started there. That's in the 1860s, 70s?
1880s.
In the 1880s. Okay. Because actually signed into a federal holiday like in the very late 1880s.
In 1894.
Okay.
New York and Colorado were among the first states to celebrate Labor Day on a state level. But it's not signed into law until 1894 after kind of a big event that goes on with labor. Just prior to that, that kind of said, wait a minute, we do need to recognize labor at a national level.
What are we going to do when all the fast food tellers are robots? What holiday do we usher in at that point?
French fry holiday.
French fry holiday. So what are some of the events that made national news that led us to the point? Because once I understand from my eighth grade history lesson, Wasn't Labor Day like one of the fastest laws ever passed through Congress?
Yes.
It kind of hit with a big steam of momentum.
Right. And that momentum is really it's drawn back to what you were talking about, that agitation of the worker in terms of being treated fairly by management, being recognized for a fair wage, safe working conditions. So labor unions were the only way that they could come together to collectively bargain for relief, for some sort of change and reform. So for about a decade, that was going on. But that wasn't just unique to the United States. Labor around the world, as a result of the Industrial Revolution, was doing that. But what was happening here in the United States, though, is that there was a fear that this was becoming rather socialist, anarchist, that there was a lot of violence associated with those things. And so,
we've got Grover Cleveland in office, right?
Uh-huh. Okay. So by the time we get to Grover Cleveland in office, one of the big events that goes on is the Pullman strike. And the Pullman strike was a railroad car strike where the railroad workers refused to do anything with Pullman railroad cars.
Chicago, right?
In Chicago, because
Pullman
treated his workers poorly and all that kind of stuff. And so all the railroad workers said, we're not going to hook Pullman cars up to our trains. We're not going to move them around. We're not going to be porters on them. We're not going to service these cars, anything. Well, that brought the railroads to a standstill. And the reason why Grover Cleveland, the president, got involved was because he said, you can't stop the trains from running. We run our mail system on that train, and you're interfering with federal business by doing that. So that resulted in maybe we should have some sort of day to recognize this agitation so that we can kind of quell this uprising kind of thing.
You stop the mail, it gives me authority to bring the feds in.
Mm-hmm.
Bring the feds in. And as I remember, there was a pretty hostile conflict there. Weren't there even some deaths?
Yes, the Pullman strike was the Pinkertons were brought in to protect the Pullman cars. Violence breaks out. The military came in. Several people died as a result of that. The lead agitator, Eugene V. Debs, was actually put on trial for basically inciting riots and whatnot. As a result of that.
So Congress gets together and decides, okay, we're going to pass a bill, take the heat off of ourselves here and pass a bill and get the labor recognized, and then everything's going to be just fine.
Right, and that's passed into law in September of 1894.
Now we'll switch gears and have a little fun talking with the Pastorinos about their experiences hiking the Grand Canyon.
So we've talked about all the hardships and all the trauma and everything of getting across the canyon.
Mm-hmm.
Why don't you each tell us, like in a couple sentences, why do you do it?
You know, that's a good question. Somebody just asked me that. Yeah, but I love it. I love the Grand Canyon. And I've done it 50 times. We've done it together probably 50 times. And every time you do it, there's something else you see, something else you feel. The group we go with is different every year. A lot of them are the same, but there's always different people. And it's odd because we start out as strangers. You know, I shake hands. How you doing, so-and-so? How you doing, so-and-so? You know, how are you, Rosie Romero? Who are you? You know, but anyway, we start out as strangers, and by the end of the trip, we're all in love with each other. It's incredible. And you know, we have here's one little tidbit here. We have a rule that if you come with us on our trip, and you don't have a marriage certificate, you don't sleep together in the cabin. So we, you know, obviously they change keys, but I have video cameras and attack dogs to catch them sneaking around their underwear at night. You know.
Only but, necking allowed.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But anyway, this one couple, for years, they met at Cedar Ridge. And that couple, I harped on them. I said, you guys are living together. Get married. You know, why are you living together? So I would never let them sleep in the same cabin on the north side when we cross over the first time. So last year, we're all sitting. We have a victory dinner at El Tovar, the most beautiful place up there on the south side. And we're all sitting there having dinner, and here comes a guy walking in. I didn't know who he was. And he says, Ed and Lori, please stand up. He was a preacher or pastor. And he actually married them at the El Tovar after about 10 years of me harping on him. So he was our security agent this year for all the other ones
awesome.
That are married.
And
what
that's
a cool story.
That's a hiker from Tucson, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah that's right.
Them,
that's
yeah.
right.
Both of them are
he
from
met
Tucson.
He met this girl at Cedar
at
Ridge.
At Cedar Ridge.
All right.
I want to know.
Come on.
I want to know. Do you have your wedding certificate?
Yes, I do.
Has anyone checked
it?
I want to see it. I'm not one to just sit here and take your word for it. I want to see that writing.
We were married 50 years on September 12th last year.
Congratulations.
So, Miss Barbara, what motivates you to do the hike?
The honest truth is this. Just like in marathons, I do the same thing every year. It has never changed 50 times. As I'm coming up, the climbing like crazy, practically half dead, I'm saying, why do I keep saying I'll do this? And the minute I get to the top, I'm like, oh yeah,
I did it.
I did it, and I'm doing it again.
It is special. And those of you listening this morning, we just want to really emphasize the fact that the hike through the Grand Canyon isn't something to take lightly.
No.
It's a whole lot harder coming out than it is going in. You're doing the easy part of the hike, the first half of the hike. The hard part of the hike is when you're a little bit depleted, you're a little bit tired, you're a little bit worn down. So please, training only, just do it slowly. Get down to Cedar Point, get down to Indian Garden, and come back. Just do the short trip first, test it a little bit of time. And with the trail systems we've got now, in particular, I love the McDowell Mountain Trail System. I mean, those are some really of the most good. Beautiful trails there
we
are.
We are the luckiest people in the world to have all this right at our fingertips.
We really are.
Grab your copy of the Saturday edition of the Arizona Republic, where Rosie teaches homeowners how to tackle every do-it-yourself project under the roof.